The following content is explicit. It's Friday, April 6th, 2018, from Slate. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. So you know how other countries have shadow ministers, usually parliamentary systems? And what it is, let's say the Conservatives are in power, the Labour Party would have their shadow minister for every department. So the defense, or they might call it the Minister of War, something like that, Minister of Defense, the main Minister of Defense would say, we should bomb those people, whereas the shadow minister would come out with the alternate policy, we shouldn't bomb those people. Now, as you go down the list of government ministers, they become less important. So you have the specter of the shadow minister of sport saying, I guess we should have tried to attempt the penalty kick in the upper left, not the upper right corner. You know, thinking about it, in a way, sports talk radio, isn't it really the shadow government for all that city's head coaches? One to grow on. So here's what I think we need. We need a shadow Trump, which is a different government aligned against Trump, but using the position of Trump against them. So this isn't a shadow president, right? Chuck and Nancy aren't the shadow Trump. Those are leaders of the Democrat. And the Trump that I think of, not a leader, not a thinker, just a guy who insults other people on Twitter. And that's what we need. We need the alternate version of that, insulting the Trump administration via the methods of Trump, and use it against the people in the Trump administration. I'm mainly thinking of one tactic, the tactic of nicknames. And I think this could really work. We could reshape the administration if we just had a shadow minister, a shadow Trump, driving the agenda, and he could set his sights on EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt. And Scott Pruitt might be out by the time you're listening to this, but he would have been booted in 12 minutes if there were just a shadow Trump to label the guy Swampy Scott. Swampy Scott wanted a $70,000 desk. Swampy Scott wanted to buy with taxpayer money a $100,000 a month subscription to a charter airline company. Hashtag drain the Scott. Now you might be saying, Mike, that's not such a good Trump impersonation. It's not supposed to be. It's a shadow Trump. Swampy Scott wants to put the lights and sirens on when stuck in traffic. You are the crime scene, Swampy Scott. First class aspirations, third class work ethic, Swampy Scott. Swamp Scott, not just a town in Massachusetts, still the administrator of the EPA. Hashtag drain the Scott, Swampy Scott. I think the idea has legs. I'm telling myself, it's my idea, so and I'm telling you it has legs. You could use it to shame administration members with nicknames that you know go right at their sensitivities and their insecurities, like committed free trader, Larry Kudlow, good capitalist. He is now pressed into service to defend Trump's asinine trade policies. One well-timed tweet with the right nickname could just destroy the guy. Saw Kudlow on CNBC, used to have credibility, now all his friends are laughing at Tariff Larry. Tariff Larry trying to tell real businessmen who used to respect him that a trade war is good for the markets. Jim Cramer, Ron Insana, David Faber, all laughing over on Fox Business, Maria Bartiromo laughing too, Money Honey laughs at Tariff Larry, sad. I would even use some Trump nicknames that Trump himself has generated. I would, were I to be named Shadow Trump. I guess this is where this is all going. Like, beleaguered Jeff Sessions. Very beleaguered. Not doing enough to stop crime. You can't spell beleaguered without AG. And without Jeff Sessions in the job, the AG wouldn't be beleaguered. Okay, I'm workshopping that one. But it all comes together with this tweet that we're going to wrap in a bow. This is the ultimate shadow Trump. When beleaguered Jeff indicts Swampy Scott, will the Treasury have enough money to fund the prosecution, or will Tariff Larry bankrupt us first, asking for a friend? On the show today, I spiel about the governor of New York and his near obsession with ganja. But first, the brothers Karamazov is a philosophical Russian novel that tackles issues of mortality, death, and love. The brothers Kondabalu, well, that's pretty much the same with those guys, except the word order. It's called the Kondabalu Brothers. There are the podcast that pairs Hari and Ashok Khandabalu, and this podcast can go anywhere. Let the conversation that follows be a small indication of that.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PIE, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know,
trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcast, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
The Khandabalu brothers are indeed Khandabalus and brothers. Ashok, well, you ever hear of the rap group Das Racist? Thank the Hype Man, because that's one of the things he did. Never heard of him? Can't blame the Hype Man. Hari Khandabalu is a great comedian. He's not just into human rights. He literally is a master of human rights. And his Hulu documentary on Simpsons character Apu got many plaudits and credits. An interesting look at that. Together, these two guys have a new podcast, which is based on a long-running live show they've done and do. It's basically two brothers talking to each other in front of an audience, sometimes acknowledging the audience. Hey, guys, thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Mike. You should know it's True TV.
It's True TV.
Here's the thing, man. If people want to see it, they'll find it.
Yeah.
And if they want to criticize it, they don't need to see it to do that.
So True TV has the first round of NCAA games.
Yes, correct.
Has I believe, like the wacky prank show.
Yeah, that's right.
Right,
yes.
And then
several. Actually.
Yeah, you with the sociological look at
correct.
A beloved comic book character.
That is correct.
That's their. What's the age difference between you?
Two and
guys?
A half.
Two and a
yeah.
half. Mm-hmm. How close were you guys growing up?
Very. We were close. Always really close. I mean, Ashok never like. I never bullied my younger brother. If anything, Ashok was always the tougher one anyway. So, and it's 2.5 years, which I know doesn't seem like a lot, but I think it's pretty clear I'm the older one and he's the younger one. The dynamic, like in the podcast, like I think it's fairly.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I was thinking about the podcast, which is, we've never met Ashok, but you and I have. And Hari, you're a guy who definitely wants to have some radical changes in society. And
yes.
yet, on the podcast, you want society to be remade and ordered in a better way. You don't want anarchy, and you
no.
are also not one of these, I'm going to drop out and just live on my own. You want everyone
yeah.
to get together and agree on a better way to do
yes,
things.
Yes, yes.
And that's conservative in a way.
All right. Well, Wavecast is what it should be called. And if people who end up
Wavecast is better.
Okay.
Check out our Wavecast. I'm doing a new Wavecast with my friend.
We don't
it's
call,
better.
Yeah, but here's the problem. Then when we promote the show, it's like, tell us about your new podcast. We don't call them podcasts. We call them Wavecast. Like it doesn't matter what we say. We're seen as rabble rousers.
Still needs to be changed, and we should sacrifice the show, our careers, our lives.
I'm not.
To be
I'm
the
not,
first or not.
Fuck that. I'm not. I'm 35. Somebody else has to fight those battles. We're calling them a podcast, and we're gonna stick with it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a little uptight. I mean, that's I talk about revolution, but when I actually think of revolution, it seems very messy.
Yeah,
it seems like it's not a lot of order. People in the streets killing each other. Mm. Like, it's not the way I would do things. You know, my revolution has more committee meetings. That's the problem.
Well, that is the real way that all the revolutionaries these days are operating. Like the Occupy Wall Street.
Oh,
there,
I mean,
a lot of committee meetings.
Great organization, though. These kids, man. These Parkland kids. I used to hate group work in high school. How these kids pulled it off.
Well, you know what it is? Were you in the drama club or the debate club? They're all
no.
the drama kids.
Oh, yeah.
And
so
the journalism kids.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, after college, you go to different colleges?
I went to Bowdoin College. Ashok, well, he has an interesting story.
College? Yeah. I barely went to my last 2 years of high school, but was allowed to graduate with a New York State degree, but not an official Stuyvesant High School. It's a public specialized science high school degree. And then I spent three...
So, like, wait. Uh-huh. So you were physically at Stuyvesant, but just not doing classes?
No, I very rarely came in for the last 2 years, but...
And just to so people from outside New York understand, yes. Stuyvesant High School, basically a school that many Asian parents would kill a guy to get their sons and daughters into. Yes. And you just frittered it away.
Yes. Okay. I am aware and extremely guilty about having wasted my position and slot at Stuyvesant High School. Yeah. I wouldn't say extremely guilty.
All you have
guilty,
to do is test in. I guess you tried to test out and they kind of let you.
They didn't want to blow their retention rates. So that you what would happen is every time I showed up, you know, every month or every couple of weeks to hang out and they found me and they were like, it's that kid, I'd be brought to the guidance counselor. The guidance counselor is very sweet. You know, I go in there and be like, I'm bummed out and I don't care about this and I'm sad, which is true. And she'd be like, all right, you're going to have to go to class, but you can leave today. And then I come back a month later and that kind of went on for 2 years.
Wow.
So Mike, for like 2+ years, none of us knew this was going on. Parents didn't know. I didn't know. Because Ashok, like when it was time for report cards, he would get his own report cards printed with fake grades. So we all thought he was like a National Honor Society. He would do these fake things and he'd get away with it, just getting lazier and lazier. The last report card of his high school career, he does it by hand. He changed the grades by hand. And that's how we figured out what was happening.
Wait, so were you taking the actual report card and fiddling with it, or are you just making up your own?
No, scanning and photoshopping.
And does it look like the real report card?
Yeah, except the paper stock was a little thicker.
You'd have to be some sort of currency official to detect that. Right,
pretty much.
Because they probably, your parents didn't have the actual Stuyvesant paper stock to compare it to.
Right.
They got what? Your like freshman year report card.
Right. And they didn't hold on to those. And it had been years since they had rubbed it between their fingers, so they didn't know anybody.
Until he decided to use a pen at the very end of it.
Unbelievable. Some would say you were trying to get caught. True?
No, not at that time.
What did you do with all your free time? How did you help society?
I would take the train to... Well, how did I help society? It's not a fair question to pose to my 16-year-old self.
Yeah.
I took the train to far-flung stops a lot of the time.
Okay.
Just to kind of know what the rest of the city was.
That's
you know?
Cool. Would you say you've been to more subway stops than most people you know?
Absolutely. Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah.
All right.
But a lot of the time, I'd go on these 10, 20-mile walks back to school a lot of the time to hang out with my friends after school. So I'd be like, what is Bay Ridge? You know, I'm from Queens. I'm going to high school in downtown Manhattan. I don't know what Bay Ridge is. Let's take the train to Bay Ridge and walk back to downtown Manhattan.
It seems terrible, and yet there are some aspects to it that seem a little like the urban version of Walden. Like, it was a journey into yourself.
Absolutely.
You were exploring your surroundings.
Absolutely.
I wouldn't recommend it for most, but...
Actually, I would recommend it for most. Not in lieu of going to high school.
Yeah.
But at some point in your life, I feel like, you know, if you move to a city or even if it's a city where you're from and you don't really know what constitutes the city in terms of neighborhoods, walk around 10, 20 miles.
And if you're an adult, just fake the paycheck that comes.
Right, exactly.
I mean, but your Thoreau comparison, did Thoreau...
Apt as it is.
Did Thoreau smoke a lot of weed?
Well, no, not technically weed. Right. Yeah, I'm sure
he was already there.
But the fact that you weren't just mostly playing video games is impressive.
No.
All right, so did you go to college?
Yeah.
Well, shockingly, despite all this, he still made it into UMass Amherst and the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
Yeah, those are selective colleges.
I had intentions of becoming a journalist.
Uh-huh.
And then I went to UMass because I wanted to be a social worker.
Yeah.
I spent, I believe, 3 odd weeks there, the orientation and afterwards. And then we got some percentage of the tuition back. And then I took a Greyhound bus without telling my parents to my friend's apartment and lay low for a week while I tried to figure it out.
Uh-huh.
Because I just knew almost immediately when classes began, within 2 days of not going to them, I was like, I don't have the discipline to do this. But I'm older, and this costs money now, and I'm in fucking Massachusetts.
Right. Yeah. And so when did Das Racist come up? Sorry, this is the Ash.
No, I love this. Honestly, like, as a listener, I'm really intrigued.
Yeah, I want to know about this guy who seems like highly functional, yet spent most of his time on the G train.
I mean, the weird thing about it is my brother is the smartest person I know. And I've said
definitely
this
before, not true.
I would say it's true. And I think the strange thing is because, you know, most people like who went to college, you don't read the full books.
No.
You read what you got to read.
Right.
Ashok reads the full books.
Yeah.
He like references things nobody would know.
Yeah.
So when we're on stage, I mean, it's very open. Mm-hmm. And we talk about a lot of things with great detail. And I always learn stuff I didn't know about you, like constantly. You know, I mean, there's that one section of the show called Ashok Tell Me the Truth.
Yeah.
Which is basically me asking him about something from high school when he was younger or whatever. Like, did that actually happen or did you lie to me?
Uh-huh.
And I mean, that's always fun.
Are you going to run out of those?
No. I've learned stuff.
Yeah.
Does mom know this? Have you broken this news?
I haven't blamed her for my years in the wilderness yet, but I will tonight.
Has she and your dad come to terms with it? Like, I'm sure they're happy where you are now, but when they look back, they could either say, well, it got him to where he was, or I regret that and it's embarrassing
I think it's somewhere in between or something altogether different where it's like, I'm glad that's over and I don't know what that was. I certainly could have lived a different life if I wanted to.
Yeah, but if that was true, then we wouldn't have a podcast on Earwolf.
That's
true. It all worked out.
Yeah,
we got a podcast out of it.
Everything is so glorious now.
And the podcast is a bit more structured than this with regular segments.
Barely.
You allow yourself to have the leeway. The overrated, underrated, that time in India. How many times have you been to India?
Oh, God. I mean, I've been probably like 7 or 8 times. Ashok's probably would have been about 4, something like that.
6 or 7. Three or four when I was old enough to.
You'll be able to mine that time in India for.
Oh, yeah.
Till you get to the 200th episode?
Oh, yeah. I mean, my God, yeah. Yeah. And plus, I also kind of. I want to add stuff with our parents. Like, I was thinking about, like, getting mom and dad on to do, like, you know, their stories of coming here and, like, that first year here or, like, what it was like when they left. I mean, all that stuff. I feel like it's rich material in that. And plus,
I would like to do some coaching with them beforehand.
Mom is fine. You can't coach dad. Dad is uncoachable.
Right. In a good way?
He believes that it's less about quality, more about quantity.
In jokes, in terms of jokes.
Well, yeah. She's like, I went for 3 hours.
Oh.
And it's like I think for him, it's the quantity. This is how much that it was an endurance contest.
Yeah. I mean, maybe it harkens back to a pre-internet or even television time where the
campfire time had to be filled. You have to pass the day somehow.
There's a value to that.
And it wouldn't be seen as rude to just curl up and pass out at the foot of the storyteller.
It was just it would wash over you, and then you'd come out of it and awake, and the storyteller would still be going on.
I mean, the crazy thing Ashok and I have talked about is my dad actually has incredible
stories
of living in New York in the 70s, but those stories just like magically show up one day. It's never whenever he tells a story, there are these long-winded, ridiculous things. And every now and then, in passing, he'll talk about, "Yeah, I used to love Laura Branigan and Donna Summer, and I used to listen to them when I was stocking shelves in a Duane Reade in Manhattan
in the 70s." And the kids would come in wearing these costumes from Studio 54, or we'll be driving
around,
and
I'm like,
"What?
Tell
a story about like, oh, I remember this block in Flatbush. It used to be a terrible block."
He doesn't understand what the interesting parts are.
Exactly.
The parts that are incredibly compelling about his life. I mean, I didn't know that my dad lived in Louisiana for the first year of his time in America until I was like 27.
Wow.
Like, he just never came up. And then he's like, I used to live in a small town in Louisiana, and I'd go to the Superdome to see Roberto Duran fight. I'm like, what? You liked boxing? You lived in Louisiana? Like, none of this came up.
So this would mean, though, the three most famous South Asian comic voices in America would all prominently feature their parents in their work.
Is that true?
Don't you think Aziz, Kumail?
Hassan's show, Homecoming King, is about his relationship with his father.
Hasan Minhaj.
Hasan Minhaj, yeah. Right? That's a newer phenomenon because we're a newer phenomenon.
South Asian funny people
yeah.
that we recognize yeah. as such.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I think it's been about like a decade, 15 years. It's not been that long since we were allowed to talk publicly.
The podcast, it's 5 or 6 episodes old. You did this show at Littlefield for years and years that I've seen. Would you say that more of your conversation, since becoming adults, more of your conversation, meaningful conversation, not just, you know, the business of when you're going to come, okay, it'll be 2, more meaningful conversation has happened in front of a microphone, performing for an audience than
absolutely.
In regular life.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. A lot of revelations
yeah.
and legitimate learning experiences.
God, that's a really good question. Yeah, that was true. I mean, it's weird, but it's true.
I talk to my sister all the time. I try to never have a meaningful conversation with her. Yet, if we had a podcast where we had to.
You would talk about
sure,
it all the time.
Sure.
I mean, when we initially started doing it, I think part of it, at least for me, was to hang out with my brother. You know, we had been apart for a really long time. And when we were growing up, we were inseparable, like constantly together. Like, you know, I would rarely hear my name as just Hari. It would be Hari and Ashok. Like, we were kind of always attached. We'd have birthday parties. Like, friends would invite us to their parties when we were kids, and we'd always bring the other.
Yeah.
Even if they weren't invited.
Yeah.
Like, my brother would have to come or I wouldn't go. So we were kind of inseparable. And then there were these years, key years, where, like, I had no idea what was going on in my brother's life. This kind of ability to do a live show, which we started around 2009, I'd say, it allowed us to talk freely, you know, in a way that it's for a thing. But because it's for a thing, we have to let these things go. And I think what the great thing about the show now is before, I mean, we would yell at each other. We'd get into fights on stage. We'd get emotional on stage, but in a way that wasn't controlled because it felt like a weird group therapy session where it was always our turn.
Yeah.
And now it's like we know each other even better. We're much closer than we ever have been. And I feel like, you know, I definitely love what we're doing with the podcast. And I really don't hear anything else like it, to be honest.
Well,
it's an interesting way to also think about how two people who grew up very close, 13 years in the same household, what happened that we ended up so differently. You know?
That's always fascinating.
Yeah. And I feel like every year, a couple more pieces fall into place, but it'll never be anything that you can concretely, you know, figure
out. One day when you're 104, I got it! And then you die, yes. Ashok Khandabalu, Hari Khandabalu, are the titular Khandabalu brothers. The podcast is on Earwolf. Their live show is recorded at Littlefield. In fact, April 22nd at Littlefield in Brooklyn is the next live show. Their podcast, called the Khandabalu Brothers, is available now. And if you want to see Hari live April 7th, at the Wilshire Ebell Theater in L.A., Hari and Ashok, thank you guys so much.
Thank you so much, Matt.
This episode is brought to you by The Jordan Harbinger Show. You've heard me talk about The Jordan Harbinger Show because it's one of my favorites. He does in-depth interviews with some of the world's most fascinating minds. I can name a few: Barbara Boxer, Anderson Cooper, Michael McFaul, the Ukraine or Russia ambassador talking about Ukraine. One I recently listened to was Stanley McChrystal, the former general, and he told an interesting story about revering Robert E. Lee. But then, after having a portrait of him for 40 years, he's a 63-year-old man, throwing it in the trash. Because his wife says, you know, what that picture and that man means to you, it doesn't mean to other people, and you have to understand that. And then in the interview, they got around to the point where McChrystal talked about that interview in Rolling Stone magazine that pretty much ended his career, where it got to the desk of Barack Obama, and it had McChrystal saying unflattering things about the war effort, and just how he talked to his wife and how they decided not to be bitter and not to wallow in it. He could have taken some shots at the process, the reporter, or the president at that point, but he didn't. It was just an overall good interview. It was facilitated by Jordan's excellent interview style. Whether Jordan is conducting an interview or giving advice to a listener, you will find something useful that can apply to your own life in every single episode of The Jordan Harbinger Show. That could mean learning how to ask for advice the right way or discovering a little mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. Search for The Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R, like the first 3 letters in hard, B-I-N-G-E, as in how you'll want to catch up on all the episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And now the spiel. Cynthia Nixon, who is running for the Democratic nomination for governor of New York, came out for marijuana legalization. Because Hollyweird is wild for the wacky tobacco, am I right? So some reporter asked the current occupant of the governor's mansion if he, too, endorsed the platform Yes We Cannabis. Andrew Cuomo was quoted in the New York Times as saying, well, actually, I'm not going to just say the quote. I'm going to share with you how I was made aware of the quote. Here's my producer, senior producer, Mary Wilson. She presented me with the governor's quote in this way.
Okay, here's the abridged quote from Cuomo. He says, "This is an important topic. It's a hotly debated topic, and it'd be nice to have some facts in the middle of the debate once in a while."
Okay, that seems fine.
Now tell me, was there a pun in that sentence?
Was there a pun in what you just read?
A pun.
Maybe something with hotly debated, like you have to light a marijuana cigarette, but now with vaping and with edibles, I don't know that you need heat. But I do not think any of that qualifies as a pun. Why do you ask?
Because here's what the governor thought.
Okay.
"This is an important topic. It's a hotly debated topic. Pardon the pun. And it'd be nice to have some facts in the middle of the debate once in a while."
So he flagged himself for creating a pun, even though there is clearly no pun there.
No pun there.
Okay. I mean, I guess if he had said something like, "This is the kind of issue that sparks the public's imagination and it comes across the desk of a governor in his role of the highest officer of the state," you know, if he pledged to work on it 24/7, to say nothing of 420, that would be a pun. But yes, what Governor Cuomo said is not a pun.
Although if he had said the pun you said, he would have been voted out of office very quickly.
Yeah, and that would have been fair. All right, but he would definitely get my vote. Thank you, Mary. But, you know, it is kind of odd that my governor, knowing him as I do, was so unable to make an actual bona fide marijuana reference. Yes, he's 60 and he's been in politics all his life, so maybe he's still of the generation that thinks any association with marijuana could kill a political career. But what I did was I delved into the record of his public comments, and I found that Andrew Cuomo is constantly making marijuana references. This is basically all the guy talks about. It's kind of crazy. Marijuana references, both oblique and overt.
"Our federal government is working to roll back so much of what we have done."
Yeah, they are.
"He really dug the trenches for sewer pipes."
Oh, was it just the pipe, Mr. Governor?
"Your big box of paper.
That's all?"
"There are roaches."
Aha. And what, if I may ask, my first dude, what are your favorite strains of herb?
"The Grand Dragon of the old dinosaurs."
Trippy and mellow, I do have to say. And where do you source your product?
407 acres on Jamaica Bay.
I get it. That is the stuff right there. How much value would you place on your stash?
"A record high of $800 million.
Oh, boy. If you got them, smoke them, am I right?
"Are we fired up today?
We are now. In fact, I think it's kicking in. Whoa. What was that stuff that you were saying to me, right, when you were, like, just getting out of your head a little bit?"
"There are special words that you remember when they're said. Like the word aardvark. Somebody says aardvark in a sentence, you remember it. I have an aardvark. You will remember that. My daughter is a cyclops. You will remember that."
Totally, dude. Oh, my God, I got to write that down. That is so good. I never thought of it like that. Listen, Andy, do you want to go to White Castle? What? Oh, you want to break out the hard stuff? I don't know, man. Like what?
"The double track on the Ronkonkoma line."
You know what, man? That's cool. That's cool. That's just not my scene, right? You hang out, you know, you do what you need to do. I'm going to go. I'm going to listen to some Allman Brothers. Maybe I'm going to crash. Like, no judgment. Totally no judgment. Just not my thing. You know what I'm saying?
Nip it in the bud.
You get it. You so get it. And this has been our special gist version of Dude, Where's My Susquehanna River Dam Bond Issue. By the way, postscript, and we did have a little fun at the governor's expense there. It was all just in chiding him good-naturedly, I hope. But in my research, I actually did come across one piece of sound, and I will play it for you. And it is real. It is not edited. And I do not know if he knew what he was saying, but I also do not think this piece of sound, this cut of tape, I don't think it was by accident. Here, let's just listen.
I think there's a great opportunity in hemp farming. Hemp can be used for many, many products. I think it's a budding industry.
There was no pause or smile in his delivery, no laugh, no chuckle, no acknowledgement. Maybe someone else put it in his speech and he was just reading it. I think, though, what that proves is our thesis, after all, that Andrew Cuomo has no idea what a pun about marijuana actually is, and our work is done. And that's it for today's show. Pierre Super Lemon Hayes, Bienna May, produced The Gist and that sweet sitar solo. Mary Jane Wilson is The Gist senior producer, and her middle name is definitely not Jane. She wants you to know. Steve Bubba Kush Licktie is executive producer of Slate Podcasts, which he likes to ease you into gently while experiencing a calm euphoria. The Gist. We are an earthy skunk whose effects are clear-headed and uplifting. They just won't slow you down, especially if you listen on double speed. Oomperoo deperoo dooperoo, and thanks for listening.